You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 3rd, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, everyone. And when you're listening to this on June 6th, keep in mind that it is National Huntington's Disease Awareness Day.
Awesome.
I didn't even know they had this.
There's got to be a National Awareness Day for everything, right?
You'd think so. There's a lot of them.
Well, sure what is Huntington's Awareness Disease Day?
Well, Huntington's disease is a neurodegenerative disorder, and it was named after physician George Huntington, who first described it accurately in 1872. It has no current cure.
Oh. That's correct.
Such a downer day to pick. It's important.
Well, it was either that or this is, you know, D-Day, June 6th.
That's also kind of a downer.
Yeah, so I figured.
So nothing good happened on June 6th ever? I mean, come on, really?
No, wait, it's 6-6, right?
It is.
A few years ago, people were all up in arms about the Mark of the Beast day, 666.
Oh, they're outraged.
I like Huntington's disease better.
That's an awful thing to say, Steve. Why would you say that?
Then the Mark of the Beast?
Oh.
I should say I like talking about Huntington's disease.
That's
better.
More like it.
Well, that's because you're a neurologist.
I know something about it. That's right.
Well, Steve, then why aren't you saying anything?
Like, I don't know. I wanted to see what Evan knew. Well, I could tell you it's a genetic disorder. It's a trinucleotide repeat with amplification and anticipation.
Uh-huh. No one knows what that means.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, I know.
It's a causes degeneration of the basal ganglia as well as more
so far
as
you're
cortical
right.
changes.
Keep going. Uh-huh.
Right. So it's a progressive dementia and movement disorder that causes people to move involuntarily. They have these writhing and kind of jerky movements.
Dementia as well, huh?
And why is there no cure for this?
Because it's a neurodegenerative disorder. We haven't cured any of them yet.
None of them.
Yeah, ALS, Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, you know, Alzheimer's disease, you name it. Which we haven't cured any of them. Not Guillain-Barré. Guillain-Barré is an autoimmune disease.
Well, there you go. See, I can't throw a curveball by you.
No. Right.
Now, I feel like it's my job now to say something that like 90% of our audience will know about and be interested in.
How about Oprah Winfrey?
Let's talk about Oprah, guys.
All right, let's talk about Oprah.
Man, I hate Oprah. Have I mentioned yet how much I hate Oprah?
Yeah. Yes, you have.
But the nice thing is that other people are starting to realize it as well, like mainstream media.
Right. Newsweek took on Oprah full frontal. It was awesome.
What a great article.
Jeez,
wow.
Don't even bring
Please
it up
don't
like
say
that.
Oprah and full frontal in the same sentence.
They really took her to task. I mean, I've never seen a mainstream article really take her the way they did. They, you know, criticized.
Please don't say take her. No, it's not.
Or task.
They did criticize her style in a lot of ways. For example, like pretending to be just your everyday girlfriend, you know, although she's the one who happens to have billions of dollars. But they mainly focused on the thing that gets us so upset about Oprah, and that is her promotion of nonsense and quackery. She, of course, has been promoting the anti-vaccination movement like Jenny McCarthy. She promotes The Secret, just, you know, wishing your cancer away with magic. She promotes, you know, all kinds of quacks. She's
Dr. Christian Northrup, who teaches you that you can direct your chi to your vajayjay.
Vajayjay, yo, what's up, baby?
I'm an adult and can say a word like vagina, but apparently Oprah and Christian Northrup cannot.
Well, that's what they say.
Well, the censors are listening, you know.
If you would be just horribly disturbed, on Skeptic, I did a post about a year or two ago showing this clip of Oprah and her gynecologist, Dr. Northrup, showing the women in the audience how to turn themselves on by directing their chi to their vajayjays.
What?
It's haunted me. Haunted me for years.
I think they called that the TMI episode.
The brass tacks is Oprah displays an enormous amount of BS on her show. Like, she'll bring on someone like Suzanne Somers, who sadly is a complete kook, who is, you know, riddling her body, you know, pumping her body full of hormones and vitamins and all this crap. The bottom line is that it's very unlikely that anything that she's doing is causing a benefit. And the way that Oprah presents it, you know, by the end of the interviews that she does with these people, it just pretty much evolves into she agrees with them and what they're doing must work.
She does present them very positively. She basically agrees with them at the end. But the key thing, and the thing that, you know, Newsweek really did a good job of calling her on, is that she takes no responsibility for promoting quackery and nonsense. Now, when she was called on that, she still is not taking any responsibility. She essentially said in response that she's just presenting information to her audience, and her audience can make up their own minds.
Oh, okay.
Right, which is always the response. Like, whenever we criticize producers or anyone who's putting really harmful, gullible, incorrect misinformation on to their venue, they always say, we're just providing information, and the audience could make up their own minds. But that is a cheap cop-out. She is giving a platform to millions of people, to people who are spreading misinformation. She does not balance that information, you know, really at all. Sometimes, like when Jenny McCarthy's on, she may read some really lame-o prefab statement from the CDC, but that is not providing balance to the impassioned plea that we're getting, you know, from her guest. And when Oprah, you know, essentially agrees with them and is promoting them, that's what her audience is listening to, not this little quickie disclaimer that she's reading from the CDC.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, her not confronting the person she's interviewing or having a discussion with and even saying, hey, you know, how valid are these claims? Like, her just sitting there smiling and nodding is enough to make people run out and buy these products or, you know, believe in the things that she's presenting on her show. Oprah is one of the biggest problems that we have to deal with.
If her not the biggest.
Yeah, I mean, just her media presence alone, or the power of what she says and thinks is, you know, it changes what people think around the world on a weekly basis.
And it's not just her TV show. It's her magazine as well, you know, which is part of the Harpo conglomerate or Harpo, you know, enterprise or however you want to describe that. She has a lot of different ways of reaching out to people. You know, she certainly makes the rounds on news and interviews and so forth. So it's even more than just her show. She really does stretch out in just about every kind of medium that she has a hand in.
And it's going to be a lot more than just that hourly show. Because did you read the part where she's striking a deal now to launch her own cable TV channel that's going to reach 70 million homes called, of course, the Oprah Winfrey Network. And it's going to include only Oprah-approved programming on health and living well. Oh, wow.
There we go. And right? Wow.
Whoa.
When Oprah announced the deal, she said that, I will now have the opportunity to do this 24 hours a day on a platform that goes on forever. Oh. You know that's one of the signs of the Armageddon.
I think so.
I want to say bravo to the two writers of this article, Weston Kosova and Pat Wingert. They did a great job with this article. I can't wait to see what's going to happen now.
Yeah, my one nitpick about their article is that they gave Mehmet Oz a free pass.
Yes, thank you, Steve. I was going to say
that was my one nitpick. Mehmet Oz is again to this a doctor that Oprah Winfrey essentially made this guy into his own media presence.
He's the new Dr. Phil.
Yeah, he's the new Dr. Phil. He's a surgeon, a cardiac surgeon from New York. He generally gives, you know, reasonable evidence-based advice on her show, but he also promotes a lot of alternative medicine nonsense. Yeah. And
they didn't make that clear.
Yeah, they did not. Not at all. Yeah, they
well, because all. He has actually been, for Oprah, he has been pretty much like not terrible. I mean, he does promote a lot of crap, you know, but I've read a lot of things from him where I'm suitably impressed that he's actually at least kind of presenting a skeptical viewpoint. And I know that there are plenty of examples to the contrary, but for Oprah, he's not the worst possible thing. So I wasn't totally put off that they didn't really bash him, because I think that the main problem is Oprah herself.
Yeah, I agree. But she does then promote these, by, you know, these proxies that I think do a lot of harm. But my, you know, again, my problem with Dr. Oz is that he mixes the two. He mixes scientific, you know, medicine and advice with nonsense. So it becomes indistinguishable, which I think is really harmful. It's actually a little bit easier when somebody promotes nothing but nonsense. It's a little bit easier to, you know, pigeonhole them. He blurs the lines in a very harmful way. And they did point out, the one criticism that Newsweek did point out is that Oz will sit by, you know, smiling and nodding while other people on Oprah promote abject nonsense, and he is sort of following the code, not wanting to ruffle any feathers. He will not object to abject quackery being said right in front of him on the show.
I mean, he's making bank. I mean, let's cut to the chase, guys.
But Steve, you kind of implied, though, that it's more than that, Jay, that there's some kind of unspoken, or maybe it is spoken, rule that you cannot bash Oprah experts. Do not bash other Oprah experts. That just doesn't happen, period. It just doesn't happen.
I feel a tightening in my chest when I think about what she's doing.
Well, let's go on to some other news items before Jay has a heart attack. Bob, tell us about the new information about one of the mass extinctions that's taken place.
Hey, guys. You know, second place finishers are usually forgotten pretty quickly, unless, of course, you're Adam Lambert or Susan Boyle. But this also isn't true for the second biggest extinction the Earth has ever seen, which has been in the news lately. Specifically, a volcanic eruption that surprisingly had previously been unknown. That kind of surprised me. This was apparently responsible for what may be the second biggest global mass extinction that happened, which happened over 260 million years ago during the middle of the Permian period. This story was recently published in the Journal of Science by scientists at the University of Leeds. Now, this wasn't the biggest, you know, the grandest volcanic eruption that's ever happened. There have been a handful that were nastier, but this one was still pretty bad. It's called the Guadalupean mass extinction. It wiped out more than half of life on the Earth, and it spewed out about a half million cubic kilometers over a half a million years.
Well, that's one hell of a long vomix.
Guys, doesn't that sound like a flood basalt volcano to you? A volcano that is erupting for that length of time strikes me as that it might have been a flood basalt. I didn't find any definitive
they
pronouncements.
Didn't say that it was?
They didn't know.
Bob, what's a flood basalt?
A flood basalt is a type of supervolcano. When you think supervolcano, you might think of the volcano that's underneath Yellowstone Park. That's just gargantuan volcano. It's got an immense caldera that eventually will erupt, and it's pretty nasty.
I watched the TV show about that. And I was bent out of shape for like 3 days. I'm it's going to blow.
It's scary.
I was so worried.
Yeah, right? But essentially, it's relatively quick compared to a flood basalt, which basically is this is something that the Earth has seen a handful of times. Jeez, that would be imagine the Earth's crust, a crack in the crust, and horizon to horizon, a curtain of lava a mile high.
I often imagine that.
Now, all right, Jay, you imagine that. Now imagine this. Imagine this happening for centuries. This doesn't happen. Where? This doesn't happen
that
for a week.
That can happen on Earth?
Yeah, it has happened on Earth. Something
what?
Like that for centuries. These flood basalt volcanoes will erupt for centuries. Then they take a little bit of a break. Then they start up again.
They might actually be worse than Oprah.
Yeah, right.
They're like crazy.
It's funny. The article was referring to these as the biggest mass murderers in history. It's like, okay, well, it's kind of taking a little bit of a liberty. Mass murderers is kind of weird. But so this one, this Guadalupean mass extinction, this volcanic eruption, they said that it lasted for over half a million years. I found that at one or two websites. Now, it happened in China, in southwest China. But, of course, China wasn't China back then. That long ago, there was one supercontinent called Pangaea. I'm sure you've heard of that. Like I said, this wasn't the biggest and worst volcanic eruption, but it actually had a huge negative impact on the Earth. Basically, the lava that was being spewed quickly hit the shallow seas that were in Pangaea at that time. And when the lava hit these seas, apparently it was like putting Mentos candy into a soda bottle. It created this incredible reaction that pumped just immense amounts of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, and this formed clouds all over the Earth, which cooled the Earth and then sent down acid rain all over the world. It was pretty nasty.
I mean, really, what else? What else could happen? I mean, this is like, this is a never-ending story of like walls of lava, acid rain.
It took about a half a million years for life to recover to get back to kind of where it was.
What was left after? Wow, we're talking curtains of lava here. What survived?
I guess it was somewhat isolated. You know, it only knocked out half of the life, which is a lot of life, but still there was a lot of species still left over. The take home for all of this though isn't really any of that. The really interesting thing about this is that these scientists are claiming that they are the first to find a direct link between a volcano and an extinction. Now, you might be surprised because you might think, oh, haven't we already done that? But actually, the links have been kind of a little bit tenuous. They haven't been as direct, not nearly as direct as what they're claiming that they found. And this is because the way the rock was laid down since the eruption took place. You know, since it took place in shallow seas, it's basically made a nice lava sandwich. Right, you've got the sedimentary rock. Then you've got the sandwich. You've got the sedimentary rock. Then you've got the lava, which becomes igneous rock, and then you've got sedimentary rock on top of that. And when you examine these layers, you know, you find this layer of sedimentary rock with these nice fossils that date really easily. Then you've got the lava, and then you've got sedimentary rock on top of that, and there's like almost no fossils in that sedimentary rock. And when they date the rock, it becomes clear that this happened very, very fast, which kind of gives you like a cause and effect. You know, the lava was laid down quickly and it apparently caused a lot of these mass extinctions. So according to paleontologist Professor Paul Wingle, he said that this link between the extinction and the volcanoes are perfect.
Well, Bob, I want you to know something.
Yes.
Because of you, historically in my life, I've done more Googling because of you than any other single person.
Oh, yeah?
Even more than Jenna Jameson.
Well, you're verifying all my shit, Jay?
No, I'm not verifying it, but like, you know, when I listen back to the show, but I'm like, oh boy, I gotta look that up, gotta look that up, gotta look that up, you know.
Cool, Jay.
So that pretty much paved the way for the dinosaurs, which appeared about 230 million years ago.
Yeah, the funny thing is, talk about a double whammy. 10 million years later, I know 10 million years is a lot, but in the scheme of things, it's really not. 10 million years later was the big dying. This was the... It's called the big dying. It's the... Well, Steve, was it the Permian-Cambrian extinction? This was the biggest. This was
the single biggest.
Numero uno. Yeah. We're talking. Well,
that sounds like you translated that from English to Chinese back to English.
One of those. Yeah. This is so nasty. We're talking 90% of sea life and 70% of land life. So within 10 million years, you had these two huge extinctions, one of them being the absolute biggest the Earth has seen, as far as we can tell. Not a good time to be alive a quarter billion years ago.
That's for sure.
There have been a few UFO stories in the news over the last week.
Well, specifically coming from Europe and in England, Cambridgeshire, the Telegraph paper reported that witnesses claim to have seen up to 50 mystery bright beams in the sky the other night. And there's a good picture of it. The picture has, you know, about two dozen of these dots in the sky, typical picture, and nobody knows what they are. The reporters ran out there and asked some witnesses what they saw, and they shared with them their pictures, and they noticed, one person said they noticed three lights floating past their house, only a couple of kilometers away, and then they noticed big, long strings of lights coming from the direction, a specific direction of a town. This was around almost midnight the other night. They were pretty sure that they weren't aircraft, because they were saying there was no noise, no navigation lights. Their heading and height was relatively constant and eventually disappeared out of sight.
Definitely aliens.
Definitely could have maybe been aliens. Well, what was it? Well, not a few hours later, the same Telegraph newspaper reports that the mystery of these lights is probably linked to a military exercise.
Hunting aliens? There,
right? Yeah, it's funny because the headlines say that they were linked to a daring military exercise. I'm like, ooh, a daring exercise. What were they doing? Well, it turns out it was an exercise involving the HMS Daring. That was the name of the ship.
Oh, man. Oh, that's awesome.
That's called squeezing, squeezing everything you can out of a situation to yield the best possible headline.
Those headline writers.
So these were countermeasure flares.
Flares.
Hey,
what a
come
shock.
On. I mean, really? I've never heard them do that before.
So that's a done deal then? I mean, that's it?
It's the most likely candidate.
Because the one article I read, they mentioned they actually contacted somebody from the military, and they said, we didn't have anything going on that I know of. So somebody denied it, which is like, oh, great.
Who'd they call? They called some guy who didn't know about it,
Yeah. But, again, you have the military denying it initially and then saying, oh, yeah, we had this going on. Like, great. The conspiracy people are going to go nuts.
Yeah.
And there were also planes flying overhead, apparently, that night. That were kind of following the path of these flares and countermeasures and other things that were sent up in the air. They were tracking them with radar. There it is. There's your prosaic explanation. But, this wasn't the most interesting UFO story this week.
Oh.
Not by a long shot.
No. This is the one that takes the cake. According to the Macedonian International News Agency, here's the headline. Russian scientist: UFO collided with Tunguska meteorite to save Earth.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So back in 1908, the Tunguska meteorite that fell over Siberia, leveled all the trees in the area in about an 800-mile radius.
Tunguska.
Did a lot of damage. Well, it wasn't just a natural impact or natural universal occurrence. No, this was a UFO that deliberately put itself in the path of the big meteorite or comet. Those aliens sacrificed their own lives and existence in order to help save the Earth. Because they felt, the Russian scientist, this fellow's name is Yuri Lavbin, according to his investigation, he believes that the UFO hit the meteorite, which would have weighed over a billion tons. And if something that big hit the Earth, that would have been the end of civilization, the end of the Earth as we know it, cataclysmic event. But instead, the aliens move their ship in line with the meteorite. That's where the impact took place and spared the Earth a catastrophic disaster.
Of course, that wouldn't have worked. That's really true because...
Wait a minute. This is a Russian scientist.
Yeah, what are you saying, Steve?
Come on. Yeah.
Steve, a newspaper printed this.
I understand that. But... if you have a meteor that's already entering the Earth atmosphere and rather than impacting it, it blows up, all that kinetic energy is still there. It's still going to hit the Earth. It's still going to cause all that damage. So you're not really going to protect the Earth that much, if at all, by having it blow up before it actually impacts the ground. So
yeah, well, sometimes that's actually worse.
Steve, real science has no place in this discussion.
You're right. You didn't talk about his line of evidence.
I was about to bring that up, actually.
How does he know this?
Because on his expedition to the site of the explosion, he discovered quartz crystals. He found about 10 of them. And these quartz crystals had holes in between them so that they could be united in a chain. So here's the quote from the scientist.
A daisy chain?
Yuri Lavbin. He says, "What could this chain serve for? Besides, some crystals have strange drawings on them. We don't have any technologies that can print such kinds of drawings on crystals. We found ferrum silicate that cannot be produced anywhere except in space."
And how could a rock from space ever get down to the Earth?
I don't... it had to be only have
aliens.
Been brought in by an intelligent alien vessel.
Rocks don't just get up and go to another planet, Steve.
They'll just fall from the sky.
Yeah. All right.
It's funny, he said, they found these rocks, he said, and said, "These rocks are not found on Earth." But wait a minute, you just found that rock on Earth.
Found them.
How could you pick up a rock and say, "This rock does not exist on Earth"? It obviously does. Did you see the picture of the rocks? You have to dig to some other news stories to actually get the pictures.
They look like cookies.
They look like, they look like natural crystal formation, not like something that was etched or drawn. They're not pictures. They're just lines, that the kind of lines you would expect to see in crystals. It's just completely natural. I love what he claims, that these lines are map drawings And then if you fit the rocks together, it makes like a stellar map, I guess, or navigation.
Oh, of course.
No confirmation bias there.
There you go. So
it's a sophisticated map.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's quite a sophisticated map. You think they might have something resembling, you know, I don't know, digital technology or computers at that point in time, and if they have the technology to get here. They're etching their maps onto rocks.
Skeptics have never been one to believe in the power of crystals, whether it's etchings or healing power or crystal skulls or anything like that. We're way too closed-minded.
Yes, we have an anti-crystal bias, clearly.
Well, and an anti-crystal vibe. I mean, it's our skeptical aura that actually causes the crystals to cease working.
I hate all you guys just for talking about this.
Why are you so full of hate?
Now, this is news. This is the Macedonian International News Agency.
Wow, good job, Macedonia.
Just some quick follow-up to finish out the news segment on the whole Texas Board of Education hubbub.
Texas, not so bad at all.
Yeah, some good news. Don, someone's got to stand up to those experts. McElroy was not confirmed as the chairman of the Board of Education for the state of Texas. So he was essentially removed as the chairman of the Board of Education. So good move, Texas. They haven't replaced him yet. I know, that's not all. Also, two anti-evolution bills, two separate ones, were both allowed to die because the legislature adjourned, right? So they adjourned on June 1st, and by adjourning, the two bills that
they expired.
The two bills expired, right? So it's House Bill 2800 and House Bill 4224.
They died of natural causes.
They did. They faded into the sunset.
Natural selection.
So
they evolved out of existence.
The first one was terrible. This one would have exempted the Institute for Creation Research from having to meet Texas's regulations governing degree-granting institutions. So basically, the ICR...
Basically giving them a pass.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The ICR, the Institute for Creation Research, wants to grant master's degrees in science. Can you imagine?
Oh,
the ICR being able to grant master's degree in science. But they couldn't do it because they didn't meet the criteria that for the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. So the legislature or some guys there wanted to pass a bill that would exempt them from those requirements so that they could do it.
And now they're, because they didn't get their way, they're suing over it.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
And all they have to do is watch 10 hours of Oprah's new cable TV access show and they will get there.
Get your master's degree.
And the second one was an attempt to restore the strengths and weaknesses language in the Texas State Science Standards, again, making an end run around the board's decision. Although, as we discussed previously, the board had ultimately decided to introduce other language that essentially does the same thing. Students must examine all sides of scientific evidence, for example. But this was just some, creationist-led legislative mischief that they were trying, and it just couldn't get anywhere, and both bills died. At least for this legislative session, Texas is safe for now. Well, let's move on to a couple of your questions and emails. The first email comes from Shane Nietzsche, and he writes, "Greetings, skeptics. I have listened to and enjoyed every podcast you have put out, except for the infamous Neil Adams interview, which I just can't bring myself to queue up. My question stems from a recent conversation I had with my girlfriend, who generally considers herself to be a critical thinker, although she does have her sacred cow like almost everyone does. In her case, she is a non-practicing pagan. We listen to several podcasts together, but when I ask her to listen to yours, she refuses, her reason being that she feels you have a tendency to be just as evangelical and at times closed-minded as the believers. I can think of quite a few ways to defend you in response to that comment, but I think hearing from you directly might have a greater impact. Whether you respond via email or on the show, I'll make sure she reads, hears your answer. Thanks for your time, and keep up the quality work."
Okay, let me take this one. All right,
go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I can kind of understand what she's thinking, because we come off like we know what we're talking about. Well, part of it is that we do research and have a basic understanding of what we're talking about, if not a detailed understanding of what we talk about. But the key thing that differs from what we think and believe versus from what a believer of a religion or some type of mythology would believe is that with better information that science brings, we change our opinion, just like that.
Right, that's a critical difference. There's a ton of differences. I mean, I would say, first of all, the sense that we are quote-unquote evangelical, I think what she may be perceiving there is our passion. I make no excuses for the fact that we're passionate about science, about reason and skepticism, but that's not the same thing as being evangelical. And Jay, you hit upon the key difference, is that what we're passionate about is a method of inquiry, of asking questions, of doubting everything, of trying to think for yourself and reason your way through these things, not a set of beliefs. We don't have a set of beliefs.
Yeah.
You know, that's a critical difference.
And more so, the idea of being an evangelical is to have a set of beliefs and then to constantly force them on other people. And, you know, we do have beliefs amongst ourselves, but the point of the show isn't to try to convert anyone away from any other beliefs. You know, like Steve says, it's just about asking questions. So, yeah, sometimes our beliefs creep in. We might comment on them. We all come from different biases, of course, but what we attempt to do in every episode is to strip away bias and get down to the facts and the science and what we can know about the world. And that's what it's all about.
No, I don't think it's wrong that we deliver science and skepticism in a passionate way. I mean, we're all human. It's not like the instant you become a scientist or skeptic that you lose your passion.
Yeah, I mean, clearly we share a worldview, and we are trying to promote our worldview. But again, that worldview does not really contain a set of beliefs beyond just, you know, science works and it's a pretty good thing, and we think that's the method that we should use to answer questions about how nature works, you know, empirical questions.
Yeah, I don't like when people mistake that with being closed-minded.
Yeah, that's an important point, because I could see how somebody would think we're closed-minded. But the thing is, we could tell you what it would take for us to change our beliefs, which is key.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how many times do we have to, you know, when we discuss a blurry ghost photo, a silly UFO picture, you know, I'm sorry if we sound a little bit closed-minded when after talking about that for the 100th time, and it's the same old stuff, because it's just the same old lousy evidence over and over and over that people find so compelling that we don't find compelling.
We also get tired of telling people that we're open-minded. Okay.
It does get a little tiresome.
But get used to it. The closed-minded thing is something we're going to have to answer to over and over again forever. Mm-hmm. That's just part of explaining what skepticism is really all about. And it's okay. It's just one of those things that we're just going to have to continue to explain. The fact is that true believers are closed-minded, right? People who believe in things without evidence, that's closed-minded. We're maximally open-minded because we have a set of criteria that we use for what we think is compelling evidence, what kinds of claims are adequately supported by logic and evidence in order to be accepted, and we apply those universally across the board. Obviously, I'm not saying we're perfect. Of course, we have biases and errors in our thinking, and our information's imperfect, but at least we try to be rigorous and consistent in our methods and valid in the logic that we use. And if you can put together a compelling evidence-based logical argument for something, we'll buy it.
Absolutely.
We'll change what, as Bob said, there are ways to change what we think about things. That's open-minded. All right, let's go on to another question. This one comes from Theo Dombrowski from Nanuse Bay, British Columbia. And Theo writes, "Okay, I give up. After all, with you guys as my role models, what choice do I have? I've been increasingly depressed at the way the term begging the question has come in mainstream media to mean raising the question and not what it always used to mean. Now, I have no problem with language evolving and meanings changing. However, begging the question is such a valuable term for identifying a common logical fallacy, I seem always to be using it to harpoon some blubbering claim. And now, the term is becoming useless. And I know of no other to replace it. Circular argument is almost there, but unless I'm mistaken, has a different emphasis. In fact, I was about to write to you to look for support, a crusade, a suggestion, something, when, what to my wondering ears I should hear, but you, Stephen, using the term in the new trendy way in the last podcast. What I was hoping I could point out that inconsistently you have the term in your list of logical fallacies, but alas, though it appears in virtually all such lists, it does not appear in yours, Strat." So I guess I just give up. But that begs the question, what term do I use instead?
Circular reasoning.
Right, it is circular reasoning.
It's the same thing.
Circular reasoning is not almost there, it is there.
Sorry, Theo.
So Theo was correct. I did use the term beg the question to mean raise the question in the last episode. In fact, I caught it mentally when I said it, and I thought to myself, should I bother going back and changing it or explaining it? I just went past it.
Because no one will write in and complain about
it. No, whatever.
Not on this show.
I figured I was taking a chance. But you know, here's the thing. Honestly, I've never, ever heard anyone, to me, use the term begging the question as the logical fallacy. Mm. I've only ever heard it used in the sense of raising the question. That is the far and away the common use for that term. So essentially, I know it's the logical fallacy to begging the question, which is, again, circular reasoning. I gave up a long time ago because language does change. It does evolve. The common usage of that term has so overwhelmed its original meaning and is a logical fallacy that there's just no point in trying to fight against it anymore.
Yeah, that really used to drive me nuts, even up to about a year ago or so. But eventually I decided, you know what? There are better things to do than try to tell people what it is.
Yeah, I mean,
so
usage changes. You know, it's like I don't get on Evan and Rebecca for saying often instead of often.
What?
Oh.
Just to bring up a random example.
What? Often?
You're talking about pronunciation. That's
right.
Different than.
You mean pronouncing my T's?
Yeah, when they're supposed to be silent. That's right.
Well,
you're not being a very good Niagaber there.
That is completely
the word's
ridiculous.
Often, the T is silent, but I've given up years ago correcting people for saying
what?
Often because use it's now become correct.
It's not. No, wait, back up. That is not at all the same thing. You're talking about a difference between dialects. Your Connecticut accent doesn't emphasize T's in the middle of words. And
here we go. 100 most often mispronounced words and phrases in English.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what's on the list? Often. We have mastered
according
the spelling
whom?
Of this word so well, its spelling influences the pronunciation. Don't pronounce the T. This is an exception to the rule that spelling helps pronunciation. It's not a regional accent. This is actually one of those things that's changed over time.
According to whom?
Yourdictionary.com.
Good website.
Anyway, it was just an example. And as I said, it's changed with use. I don't get picky about things like that. So begging the question, people think it means raising the question, and that's how I think of it in my head because that's how I've always heard it used. The logical fallacy is circular reasoning. It's to incorporate in the premise of an argument the conclusion that you're trying to reach, right? So the premises are the beginning of the argument. The conclusion is where you're trying to go. If you say, for example, that the Bible is 100% true, literally true, how do you know that? Because the Bible was written by God, and God's perfect. Well, how do you know that? Well, that's because the Bible says it was written by God. You're including in your premises the conclusion that you're trying to prove, and it takes you again into this sort of circular reasoning.
Well, Steve, I have a quick comment here, and this is directed at specifically Richard Saunders. It's aluminum, not aluminium.
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 Okay. Vitamins.
Skeletal. Obviously, some things are regional accents, or not so regional accents, but other things are just the change of usage over time. And this also gets to our love-hate relationship that we have on the SGU with being pedantic, because we do like to be detail-oriented, and we do appreciate being corrected, and we do appreciate feedback. But there's this line that you cross where you're pointing out nitpicky little things just for the sake of correcting others, and even when it doesn't matter. I'm not saying that's the instance in this case, but I'm saying that does happen a lot. To resist the lure of being pedantic myself, because I love being pedantic as much as the next guy.
Oh, yeah. You're always correcting us.
More so.
Always.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I interrupted.
It's some rules that for myself to say, is this worth correcting? So one rule, for example, is does this quote-unquote correction actually reduce ambiguity, increase specificity? Again, in medicine, being very precise in your terminology is important.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
And almost a day doesn't go by where I'm not telling a medical student or a resident to be more specific in their terminology, because it actually has importance to meaning. But if it doesn't have any importance to meaning, in my opinion, that's when you're just being pedantic.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. Yeah, there's certainly there are examples of people trying to control language. You know, the French, I think, certainly made a good go at it. But you can't stop the evolution of language, I think. People are going to do what they're going to do.
It's a good thing. Like, because you think about the
definitely.
Term begging the question. You know why that is so often misused? Because the phrase is not intuitively obvious.
Yeah. Right.
When you hear the term begging the question, people it sounds as if you're saying it raises the question. So that's how people use it. Okay, so let the usage follow what makes intuitive sense to most people most of the time, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know what? Circular reasoning is a much more better description of that logical fallacy, because it's much more intuitive, in my opinion.
Much more better.
You just
much
said
more
much
better.
More
it's
better.
It's much more better. Much more better.
Come on.
You know it's betterer.
Do bio.
Betterer.
It's much more betterer.
It's not
it's bestest. It's the bestest. Is it? Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Simon Singh. Simon, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's nice to be back.
Now, Simon is an author, journalist, TV producer specializing in science and mathematics. And a year ago, just about a year ago, we interviewed you about your then new book, Trick or Treatment, or Alternative Medicine on Trial, which you co-authored with Edzard Ernst, who's also awesome. And now we have you back on to talk about a new issue that's cropped up. You were recently sued by the British Chiropractic Association. Now, I know probably a lot of our listeners have some information about this, but why don't you get everyone up to speed and tell us about this lawsuit?
Yes, I mean, it's still ongoing, so I'm limited to some extent as to what I can say, but I can give you a potted history of what's happened and where we're at now and how things might progress in the coming weeks. So the book was published April 2008. In the book, we talked about all sorts of therapies, and at around that time, we published a few articles to make people aware of what we were writing about and so on. And I wrote an article for the Guardian newspaper, one of our national newspapers, and the article was about chiropractic. And it happened to be Chiropractic Awareness Week, and so it seemed like a good idea to a large extent, I think it's a promotional campaign for chiropractors, but the idea of the article was to make people aware of some aspects of chiropractic that they may not be familiar with. I laid out the groundwork of the history of chiropractic, which is that some 100 or so years ago, Daniel Palmer invented this idea that there's something called an innate energy. The innate energy would flow through our nervous system and provide health to our bodies. And therefore, a block in this innate energy would cause ill health. And the blockage typically would be associated with the spinal column. So a disjointed or misaligned spine blocks the innate energy, causes kidney problems or all sorts of other things, fix the spine by spinal manipulation or chiropractic, and you can cure the patient. The first two people that Palmer treated were one person who was profoundly deaf and one person who had a serious heart problem. And Palmer believed he cured those patients using spinal manipulation, and his philosophy was, let's cure everything with spinal manipulation. Now, today, most chiropractors have moved away from that rather odd model of medicine and tend to focus on back problems. You have a back problem, you manipulate the spine, you might feel better.
Although most, meaning maybe more than half of chiropractors, have significantly backed off of that sort of what we call straight chiropractic notion of innate intelligence and subluxations. At least in the United States, estimates are a full 30% or so of chiropractors still practice right in line with D.D. Palmer's original, you know, philosophy there. So it's still very prevalent among chiropractic.
Yeah, there's very much a spectrum, and it varies across the globe. And then there are some in the middle who tend to focus on back problems, but who also will treat conditions not necessarily associated with the back, things like asthma, colic, ear infections and so on. And that's where I focused my attention in the article. I was worried that these treatments were being promoted for childhood conditions where there wasn't really enough evidence to justify them. The British Chiropractic Association, who were mentioned in the article, obviously took offense at this and went as far as eventually suing me for libel. There were a few nasty letters to and fro to start with, but it ended up in a libel suit. And that's sort of been ongoing now for most of the last year.
Right. And their point is that you were defaming the British Chiropractic Association for saying that the treatments that they're recommending are not supported by the evidence, which is absolutely true. I mean, the evidence is dead against using chiropractic to treat asthma, for example. The only really well-designed trials we have show zero effect. So that's a completely fair statement. So how did they get any headway suing you for libel for saying statements that are true?
It's hard for me to talk about that at the moment, but your view is certainly not out of line with other people's views. The idea was, you know, how much evidence do you need to justify a treatment? Do you need just some case studies, case series? Is an unblinded trial adequate? Where is the balance of evidence sufficient to justify therapy? Now, maybe I set my bar higher than the chiropractors do. Maybe that's where the disagreement arose. I was more than willing to defend my article in court, and that's why I didn't back down. One of the problems was that the British Chiropractic Association sued me personally and not the Guardian newspaper, which is rather unusual. And so, personally, it's a lot of pressure, but, you know, I stand by the article and was willing to back it up. A big problem emerged about a month ago, in fact, exactly 4 weeks ago today, I think. We had a preliminary hearing at the High Court in which the judge was going to rule on the meaning of the article, the defamatory words. What exactly do they mean so that when we go to trial eventually, we know exactly what we're arguing about? I know what I have to defend. Unfortunately for me, the judge's ruling is that my article says that not only are these therapies, treatments not backed by evidence, but that chiropractors are deliberately and dishonestly using these treatments, even though they know they are not backed by evidence. Now, I didn't mean to say that, and I don't think that's a reasonable interpretation of my article, but it's the judge's interpretation.
Isn't it the interpretation of just one word? Wasn't it the word bogus that the judge seems to have completely misinterpreted?
It sort of happily promotes bogus therapies, and I think the judge has taken happily to mean knowingly. I would think happily means naively or innocently or all sorts of possibilities there. Mm-hmm. And bogus, as you say, does bogus mean deliberately fraudulent or does it just mean ineffective and based on shoddy science? What really worries me is that if you look at the context of the whole article, elsewhere in the article I talk about fundamentalists. I talk about some chiropractors having ideas above their station, having wacky ideas. So for me, the article paints a picture of people who are perhaps eccentric or deluded, not deliberately fraudulent. And it's going to be very, very defend the judge's interpretation at trial. And so for the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've been figuring out what to do next. We can't really defend this at trial. We could try, but it would be very hard. I don't really want to back down and settle. And so the decision we announced just a day or two ago was that we would go to the Court of Appeal and appeal the judge's meaning to see whether we can get what we believe is a more reasonable understanding of the article and one that I would be able and willing and would actually want to defend in court in due course.
Mm-hmm. Is the judge a chiropractor? I mean, it really seems odd that the judge would do this, putting you in a completely untenable position.
I'm sure he's a very decent man and a very honourable man, but there are serious problems with the English libel system, and one of the reasons for continuing is to perhaps highlight some of the problems with the libel system. So this isn't the judge that I'm talking about, but things like the fact that at this stage, for example, it's very rare that libel cases get this far. Because libel in England is incredibly expensive. If you look at countries in Europe, we're top of the table in terms of the cost of a libel case. We're 10 times more expensive than the next country, which is Ireland. And Ireland, in turn, is 4 times more expensive than the third country. And in fact, if you compare England, because it's the English libel system as opposed to the British one, the English libel system is 140 times more expensive than the European average. So typically, if a journalist is threatened with libel, the sensible thing to do is to back down early and get out, because it's just not worth the headache, the time, and the resources. It can just bankrupt you. So that's one of the problems with our libel laws. Two, I'm guilty essentially until proven innocent. The burden of proof is entirely on me. So the chiropractors don't have to prove anything. I just have to prove completely the accuracy of my article, which is an uphill struggle when the judge is saying that I'm calling them dishonest. How do I prove what's going on in the mind of an association? Not even an individual, but an association.
Right.
So that's going to make it tough. And so there are problems with English libel, and by going to the Court of Appeal, one, I'm giving myself the only chance I've got left, and two, I'm hoping that we can highlight some of these issues surrounding libel. In fact, we've just started a campaign. We announced at the same day that we were going to be going to the Court of Appeal, and the idea of the campaign is to encourage the government to re-examine our libel laws. They're a real embarrassment. They give science writers a tough time. You know, science writers have to be able to challenge and question ideas in a fair way, but in a frank way. And journalists, you know, full stop, have to be able to do that. And the really, really shameful thing, the thing that really embarrasses me as someone that grew up in England, is that our laws affect everybody else in the world. If you write an article in Boston and somebody in England reads that article, or buys your book over the internet, then you could be sued in an English court.
Mm-hmm.
So our laws of libel go far beyond these shores. And there's something called libel tourism, whereby if somebody is trying to sue somebody else, they'll typically try and bring it into an English court if they can, because the laws are just so severe.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems that the intention of this lawsuit is to have a chilling effect on criticism and open and honest discussion of controversial pseudoscientific claims, such as those on the part of the British Chiropractic Association. It's directly anti-free speech, in my opinion.
Yes, when we launched the campaign, really encourage people to try and join it if they can and sign up. It's not just a British campaign, because our laws affect everybody. So if anybody can go to, there's a website called senseaboutscience.org.uk. Great support from America. James Randi, your good self,
yeah.
Phil Plait and Penn and Teller and Alan Sokal have all come on board. And, you know, there's a real chance here. There's a government select committee looking at these laws at the moment. There's a real opportunity to try and apply some encouragement to re-examine these issues. So when we launched all of this, a chap called Nick Cohen, a very brilliant British journalist who writes for the Observer newspaper and other magazines and newspapers, Nick said that in Europe, we still haven't come to terms with free speech. We don't have such a liberal policy, and it's time that we actually adopted something much more similar to the American model, whereby if you're a public body or a public individual, you know, it's possible to write about corporations and individuals without the threat of libel, as long as what you're writing isn't written without malice or isn't completely reckless.
Yeah, in fact, in the U.S., we, in some states, this is state by state, there are so-called SLAP laws, or strategic lawsuit against public participation, which is designed specifically to counteract lawsuits which are intended to intimidate or silence critics. So I think that's a good system. So yes, you can bring a libel suit, and if you can prove somebody said something that was wrong and harmful, you have a right to compensation. But if you're doing it frivolously or with malice in order to silence your critics, it could rebound back on you. There's got to be a threat both ways. It sounds like in the British system or the English system, there is no threat to bringing a libel suit. It's like playing the lotto.
That would be an improvement, certainly. But the other way is to actually ramp down the stakes. At the moment, it's like a high-stakes poker game. You go into this. If you win the case, I'm still going to lose money because I'm never going to get all my costs back. So if I win, I'd lose a few tens of thousands of dollars. If I lose, then I'd be losing hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so it's a high-stakes poker game, and if you ratchet up the costs, then that could make it even scarier for people to get involved. The other way to do it is to start having things like a sort of a small claims court for libel, something that's quick and sharp, maybe involving enforced mediation. A lot of these claims don't involve large amounts of money, and therefore it's wrong to have disproportionately expensive trials which block participation when what's really been argued about is just a few thousand dollars here and there.
Yes, you could have a trial that costs you $30,000 to determine whether or not you owe somebody $3,000, right, is what you're saying.
Or a third of $1 million to deal with something that's just $10,000. And that's why the sensible thing to do is back off really early. I'm in an incredibly privileged position that I've been writing books for 15 years or getting on for that and involved in science journalism for a long time. And I care about this issue. I've got the time to dedicate to it. The support has been amazing. Bloggers have written about this extensively. There's a Facebook group. And it's because of that level of support that I'm keen to carry on the battle, because the warmth and encouragement and enthusiasm has been really bolstering.
Well, you're really taking a hit for the team. I mean, you're really putting, personal liability on the line here for an issue that can affect all of us. I mean, my God, I think about the articles that I've written online and 200 plus podcasts now. I'm sure I've said and written 1,000 things that somebody could probably sue me over if they really wanted to. But it's obviously, I think I stand behind everything that I've written or said, but, that's the position you put yourself in, especially if you're skeptical, and you're in the business of criticizing charlatans, quacks, cranks, and the self-deluded. I mean, that is, and now with the internet age, the notion that I could be dragged into English court is a frightening proposition. So I think you'd have all of our genuine support, but I think a lot of us recognize that this is an issue that affects all of us. And you are very graciously putting yourself in this position, or as I said, taking a hit for the team. So,
well, thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, it's much appreciated. And the more support we can get from, it would be great if the Australians came on board, and although I think their libel laws are not too clever. But if people globally started to focus on what we're doing in England, because as you say, we drag in everybody else because of the wondrous internet and the way information travels here and there. The sort of the classic sign of how bad things have got in England with libel tourism is that my understanding is that in America, states are beginning to bring in their own laws one by one, so that if an American journalist is sued in an English court, new laws in America are saying that judgment is not valid on that American citizen if that same decision wouldn't be upheld in an American court. So our laws are so bad that you're having to create laws to make up for them.
Right.
That shows how bad we've got it.
Yeah, I agree.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, there almost has to be some kind of an international standard, especially, again, now with the internet, information is global.
Well, one of our hopes is we're applying to the Court of Appeal. It's unusual for the Court of Appeal to overturn this sort of decision. So it's a long shot, but we'll keep our fingers crossed that they will listen to our appeal and they'll give us a meaning that we think is more reasonable. But if they don't, then the next stage would be to try and apply to the European Court of Human Rights and see whether they would listen to our case and give us a more reasonable meaning. And by drawing in that European angle, it begins to reflect the way that information is traveling now via the internet. It's a European, it's a global issue.
Yeah, I completely agree. This is something that, we've marveled at for years. Every time it crops up, and it does crop up a lot, in the skeptical crowd, we always just have to shake our heads. Like, how could the laws be so backwards there? I guess it's all relative, but from our perspective, it seems that way.
I think from everybody's perspective, a lot of look pretty back, apart from maybe a few totalitarian regimes. England can't really hold its head up at all very high on this kind of issue. And at the moment in Britain, that there's almost a fashion for taking on science journalists. There's a wonderful professor at University College London called David Colquhoun.
Yes.
Who writes a great blog, Improbable Science, and people may have visited it. Somebody complained to his university about his blog being hosted on a university website.
Right.
And was that appropriate for an academic who was writing about subjects beyond his speciality? And the university caved in and took down his website until, actually, international campaigning, I think, really embarrassed the university into rehosting it again properly and standing up to those challenges. And then a few months later, David was threatened by chiropractors in New Zealand for an article he wrote in the New Zealand Journal of Medicine. In that case, the editor of the journal stood up to the chiropractors. I think Frank Frizzell said something along the lines of, show us your evidence, not your legal muscle.
Right.
And that's the really important thing. If somebody disagrees about something that's written, then let's discuss it in a proper, reasonable way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we can't heap enough criticism and scorn onto the British Chiropractic Association, in my opinion, for doing this. You basically said you're promoting these therapies to children without adequate evidence to support them, and they responded by suing you rather than, oh, I don't know, publishing the evidence or showing evidence to support their decision. It really is scandalous, and there are, in my opinion, really are scoundrels for doing that.
I mean, I can't really judge them in any way. I mean, they were within their rights to do what they did, and they pursued that legal route. But very early on, The Guardian did say to the British Chiropractic Association, if you want to write a reply, you know, here's 500 words, you know, write down what you think your evidence is, and let the readers decide. And that, to me, that seems like a very reasonable option. If they wanted a clarification on what I'd written, if they wanted expressed in more clear terms, I would have been happy to have done that as well. And that was offered as well. But unfortunately, the British Chiropractic Association did pursue the legal option.
Right. I know you can't say too much about it. That's why I am. And I will extend this to the complementary and alternative medicine culture in general. In my experience, they really don't like to be criticized. They do whatever they can to exempt themselves from that kind of criticism. One good thing, in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, the skeptical movement has really become so plugged in because of the internet and Web 2.0, you know, we do have almost this rapid response kind of network of skeptics. And when things like this happen, like I know when David was asked to remove specific articles from his website, literally dozens, if not hundreds of us, you know, fellow science bloggers immediately duplicated all of the material on our own websites. The lesson has to be, if you're going to try to silence your critics by suing them or intimidating or calling their boss or whatever, that's only going to result in the magnification of the criticism 2 or 3-fold or 100-fold or 1,000-fold, whatever we can muster. And I think we have to keep doing that. That's one of the really solid things that we could do as skeptical activists, is make sure that the skeptical point of view is not silenced by these kind of bullying intimidation tactics.
It's a very interesting point you make.
Thank you.
That's great.
I appreciate the position that you're in, Simon. Well, you know, thank you, Simon, for having the personal fortitude to stick this out. You certainly have our support, and this does have implications for all of science. You know, not just skepticism, but, you know, science requires transparent, you know, critique. And if people like the British Chiropractic Association are successful in silencing their critics, then we've really lost a very important war. So thanks for fighting.
It's been my pleasure. And thank you for your support. And thank you to everybody in North America that's been supporting the case already, and he'll continue to support it in the future, I hope. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care, Simon.
Thanks, Simon.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake.
Yes.
We have a theme this week.
Oh, good.
Haven't had a theme in a while. I know how you love themes.
I do love themes.
The theme is space.
Space.
As in outer space. That's correct. Here we go. Item number 1. Neil Armstrong recently confirmed that his famous "one small step for man" phrase was written for him by a NASA press secretary. Item number two, scientists have been able to track emperor penguin colonies in Antarctica from space by using satellites to spot their droppings. And item number three, researchers find that space headache is a real and distinct phenomenon and call for it to have its own classification. Jay, please go first.
I'll start with the last one. It said, researchers find that space headache is a real and distinct phenomenon and call for it to have its own classification. Clearly, what they're forgetting here is that astronauts get spaceman ice cream, okay? And we all know that ice cream causes headaches. Therefore, that one is definitely true. Scientists have been able to track emperor penguin colonies in Antarctic from space by using satellites to spot their droppings. Totally believe that. Neil Armstrong recently confirmed that his famous "one small step for man" phrase was written for him by a NASA press secretary. I thought he made that up on his own. What do you know, Steve?
I know the answer.
I'm going to say the first one is the fake, Neil Armstrong.
Neil Armstrong. Okay, Bob?
Let's see, the space headache being real and distinct. I could see that with the microgravity affecting blood flow, perhaps. That doesn't sound out of the question to me. The satellites tracking penguin colonies by the droppings. Initially, I thought, well, wait, how are they going to see something that small? But I would think that the droppings kind of do add up after a little bit and to a size that would be discernible by a satellite. So that's kind of makes sense to me as well. The Neil Armstrong, "one small step for a man," that one, I don't know. That just doesn't sound right to me. I don't think a secretary had any say in any of that. I'm going to say that that is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Man. That one seems suspicious to me as well. Although I do seem to remember like a long-standing understanding that, you know, this wasn't just something, it wasn't a line that he just made up on the spot. You know, he had like practiced it and rehearsed it. But I'm not sure I know who came up with it. I do think that I agree with Bob that satellites could track emperor penguin poop if there's, you know, a lot of them in the colony. And plus, I imagine their poop is dark colored and it's going on top of snow. So that could be easy enough. And space headache, I agree with Jay. Astronauts eat ice cream. Ice cream causes headaches, therefore space headaches. So, I think that I'm going to have to go with the guys on this one. Neil Armstrong, his secretary, press secretary, did not write "one small step for man."
Okay, Evan?
Yeah, I'm agreeing with the gaggle and going with that as well. The space headache, real distinct phenomenon, have its own classification. Yeah, I don't see why not. And then the only thing about the tracking the penguin colonies in Antarctica, spot their droppings. I mean, you know, I'm sure the wind's blowing down there and the snow. I mean, how long can you see the dropping for? I mean, or does that matter? You probably only need it for, you know, a matter of seconds, but that kind of maybe was going to throw me off. But I think the Neil Armstrong one is the fiction.
Okay. Well, let's take these in reverse order. You all agree that researchers find that space headache is a real and distinct phenomenon and call for it to have its own classification is science. And that one is science.
Yay!
But I must point out that the headache could not be an ice cream headache because then that would be an ice cream headache, not a distinct phenomenon.
Yeah. Oh, darn.
Oh, wow.
You mean our logic was flawed?
Yeah. Your logic was flawed.
The fact that ice cream headaches are caused by the cold.
Yeah, and that spaceman ice cream is basically like just like a cream bar that's room temperature.
I love spaceman ice cream.
Tang headaches.
Right, the dehydrated ice cream.
Am I the only one that finds it like completely delicious?
Mm. I've had the space ice cream when I was, you know, at NASA, but it kind of like just melts away in your mouth, you know.
Yeah, like M&Ms.
Not in your hands.
So this is a study looking at basically surveying the astronauts. They surveyed 17 astronauts, and 12 of them reported having 21 headaches on different missions. but they were not associated with motion sickness. So one of the thinking was okay, they're getting headaches because they're getting motion sickness, but the headaches occurred independent of symptoms of motion sickness. So that's why that led them to think that it's its own phenomenon, not a secondary headache to something else that's happening.
What if they're just stressed out? Like, you know, they get headaches because, you know, they're in friggin' space, right?
I mean, you know, stress could cause, like, a tension headache, but these headaches were more disabling than you would expect from a tension headache, and they had an exploding quality to them, which is also not typical. Tension headaches feel more like a vice around your head, not that they wouldn't explain it as exploding. So it doesn't fit really any known headache type. It's not an ice cream headache. It's not a motion sickness headache. It's probably not a tension headache. So they said, hey, it's its own kind of headache. It's its own phenomenon. Now, whether or not their recommendation will be picked up remains to be seen, but that's the recommendation that they're making. They do think, Bob, that the root cause is probably microgravity, right?
Yeah.
The pressures inside our blood vessels, inside our head, you know, is not adapted to microgravity. And in a lot of individuals, they gets thrown off and causes headaches.
We weren't created that way.
We have not been optimized by evolutionary processes to the conditions of microgravity. That's correct.
We were intelligently designed, but not that intelligently designed.
Let's go on. Number two, scientists have been able to track emperor penguin colonies in Antarctica from space by using satellites to spot their droppings. And that one is science.
Yay.
That one is science.
Yay, poop.
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 Yeah, the satellites
do they use sonar to track?
So what they found is that after the penguins have been huddling in an area for a while, that their guano will stain the snow, the ice, a reddish brown, and that stain remains long enough to be detected by satellites. You can see the pictures on the link that I'll provide. So this is giving them a lot more information than they've previously had about the number and location of emperor penguin colonies in Antarctica, because the penguins themselves are too small to be seen by the satellites. So there you go.
Boop.
That's remarkable. And therefore...
We win!
This means a wedge. That Neil Armstrong recently confirmed that his famous "one small step for man" phrase was written for him by a NASA press secretary is entirely fiction.
We knew it. That was too easy.
Right. Now, a press secretary is not like his secretary, right? It's somebody who does press releases and things like that.
Correct.
So,
coming, Mr. Armstrong.
Not that a secretary wouldn't be smart enough to write a simple line.
Yeah, but just to clarify.
But yes, that is
Anyway, but a recent analysis of the audio tape of Neil Armstrong's famous phrase, "that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind," did come to a couple of interesting conclusions. Now, there has been this ongoing controversy about whether or not Neil Armstrong actually did say "one small step for a man," but the "a" was either dropped from the transmission or was lost because he didn't emphasize it enough. And a previous analysis suggested that maybe the "a" is in there if you listen closely enough. But a more recent analysis, this one done by a Dr. Chris Riley, did a detailed analysis, and he says that the "a" is simply not there. It's not dropped. It's not rolled into the next word. That Neil Armstrong basically did not say it.
Flubbed it.
He flubbed it.
Wait, but how does he know? Like, if it was lost from the transmission from the moon to the Earth.
No, what they did was they when they examined it, the R and the M were right next to each other. For man, there was no space. So, imagine
they ran through Audacity and looked at the waveforms.
Right. Yeah, right. Imagine the most important thing you'll ever say in your life, and you flub it.
But he's stepping on the moon at that moment. I mean, come on. I mean, he'd probably be pissing in his spacesuit. Most people would be.
Well, they actually had to piss in their space suits, but that's...
I meant at that exact moment, thank you.
Yeah, they did piss in their space. They did other things there, too.
At that moment.
He had other things on his mind. He was very distracted, yes.
So actually, you wouldn't know. Maybe he was taking a pee at the time he said those immortal words.
He probably was. There is general agreement, though, that by dropping the A, it made the phrase much more poetic. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. I agree. I think that sounds a lot better than that's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind.
Yeah, except for a man makes sense and man doesn't.
Yeah, but everyone knows what he means.
Correct.
Right? That's what you mean by poetic license.
We all know what it means because we know it's what it was supposed to be. This isn't a case of language adapting.
No, it's not. You're right. It's a case of poetic, accidental poetic license, we'll call it. It makes for an interesting story, but he did just forget to say
it. I think that's very nice to say, but I think it's wrong.
The other question is, did he write that phrase, or was it written for him? Neil Armstrong claims he wrote it for himself.
But didn't he, not just that, didn't he say he pretty much thought of it on the spot?
No.
Isn't that what he claimed?
No.
I think he claimed that he pretty much kind of thought of it.
I think he scribbled it on the back of his glove and he tried reading
it. Not that he hadn't thought before about what he would say, but the way in which he was saying it, the exact words that he was saying were a bit impromptu. This analysis seems to support that interpretation. They are basing their judgment on his inflection, saying that the way he inflected the words and the way they flowed is more consistent with somebody speaking off the cuff than somebody speaking a memorized phrase or somebody reading.
I'm skeptical of that.
Yeah, that seems a pretty thin line of evidence, but for what it's worth, their linguistic analysis, they say, supports the conclusion that he was speaking off the cuff. I don't know how sensitive or specific that analysis is, you know. So that's their story, and they're sticking with it. An interesting historical little aside to one of the greatest moments in humanity, stepping onto the moon.
But anyway, the point being, we won.
Yes, we beat the Ruskies.
Who's that noisy?
Noisy. Who's that noisy? Okay, let's play it back, just in case you forgot. Here it is.
That might be a pretty effective demonstration of my supernatural abilities, but if there's one thing I want you guys to take away from this talk, it's that no matter whether you see it in print, whether you see it on TV, whether you hear about it from a friend, if it sounds supernatural, if it sounds beyond what's possible, you better believe that you are not getting the entire story.
Okay, so that was the voice of one Brian Brushwood.
You all got it right.
Yes, and everybody got,
Evan,
and everybody
read their
got
names.
It right. For some, I'll start with the A's.
Aaron Aronson. No.
actually, someone named Aaron was the first
quadruple
one to get it right.
A auto repair.
Ironically, Aaron STL, which I can only imagine is abbreviation for St. Louis
or Seattle.
Aaron St. Louis. He got it first, and so did about 100 other people, but. I hadn't, I guess shame on me that I'd not known who this person was before. No, I'm serious. I'd not seen any of his material.
Well, Evan, to redeem yourself, your task is to book this guy for an interview on the SGU.
And many of our listeners gave us that very same suggestion. So, yeah, I'm going to, I'll find Mr. Brushwood and invite him on. And hopefully he'll come on. And
come up with a more difficult one for this go-round.
Ooh, you want a difficult one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Give it to us.
Here it is.
That's a neti pot.
I think that's the Langoliers.
Oh my God, Langoliers.
Did I get it? Am I right?
No. But that's this one will prove challenging, I think. So give it your best guess. Send in your answers.
Thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
Jay, now it's time for the skeptical quote.
This is a quote from none other than Phil Plait, sent in by a listener named Robert Fulmer. This is one of the reasons why I love Phil. Check out this quote. Some people try to tell me that science will never answer the big questions we have in life. To them, I say, baloney. The real problem is your questions aren't big enough. Phil Plait!
Good old Phil.
Heard of him.
Yeah, that's a good quote from Phil.
Yeah, Phil.
I am formally announcing the big secret project. There is a big secret project, indeed. Been working on it too hard, too long. That's why I'm sick and tired right now. But it's coming, and it may very well be revealed at TAM. Nobody knows.
Could be.
Maybe, maybe not.
It will be ready for TAM. Yeah.
And it will change the way people move around cities. How about that? It's
Nice segue, Jay. Well, thank you for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
It was fun being joined to you.
That was a treat.
Now let me go.
Yes.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.